January 2010 brought the release of a second edition of Leadership in Self-Deception, a word-of-mouth wonder in the business leadership and personal development markets. The book is authored by the Arbinger Institute, an international organization devoted to helping people identify and solve the problem of self-deception. Today I'm speaking with Jim Farrell, Global CEO of Arbinger, about the Institute, his role, and the launch of that second edition. Jim, it's great to speak with you today. You're an author, a public speaker, consultant, business leader, and a retired lawyer. Will you tell us about the path that led you to become Arbinger's CEO?
Well, you know, it goes back many years, back to the mid-1980s, really, when I was a student of Arbinger's founder, Terry Warner. I had completed my studies for an economics degree. I had a couple of courses open in my last semester to take, and I took a couple from Terry. I'd gotten to know him on some leadership work we'd done at the university, but I'd not taken a course from him yet, so I took two. I took a philosophical writing course, and then I took a course on his work within philosophy, and it was amazing. And those two courses just captured my soul, really, and certainly my interest, and I ended up putting off my plans, which had been to go to law school. I put those off and stayed and got a philosophy degree as well, which was just exhilarating. I went just round the clock, essentially, and completed that in a year, and then almost went off and became a philosophy professor myself, but ended up following through on the law school plans. And so I went back to Yale to law school, and at Yale there's kind of an interesting requirement there. I don't know that other schools have this, but they have what's called a supervised analytic writing requirement, which is kind of a master's thesis level writing. And so I chose to write on this work, what's now known as Arbinger's work, applied to race relations in the United States historically and presently, and then looking forward into the future. And what that meant really for me was, it was an opportunity for the better part of a year, at least a year, to just get in and grapple with the ideas, which were still formative in many ways at that time. I had old class notes. I had some writings that Terry had done. But with those things, and then just sort of off on my own, I was left to grapple and try to figure it out in this context. And it was an amazing experience, I think really important for me to do that. One of the things I've learned over time is that you can kind of talk your way around a lot of holes in your knowledge, you know, but when you try to write, the holes in your knowledge become completely obvious, and you just can't skirt around them. So that was an important year for me to really dive into the foundations of this work. I ended up completing that. It was a marvelous experience for me. Well, then I went away and started practicing law at a very large law firm. I was out in California, and it was there 3 years doing that before Terry and I reconnected. And in the meantime, what had happened was that this Arbinger organization had really come into existence. I mean, there'd been something called Arbinger since the late 70s, but it wasn't a company at all. But it had grown in the early 90s, so that there were some things going on. There was some commercial demand for this work, and Terry and I sort of entered into conversations. And long story short, about a year later, I ended up leaving law and joining with Terry and two other of his former students. So the four of us together, really about 1995, 96, that time frame, got together and reinvented Arbinger. And so that was quite an amazing time. There weren't really clients to speak of at that time, but what we had was we all had this collective faith that we had this body of material that was completely unique in the world. I mean, amazing. And that the world would believe that too when it came to know it. And so we started growing really from that time, started writing, clients coming, Leadership and Self-Deception came out in the year 2000, which changed everything for us. And we, by the way, it's just come out now again. We just have our second edition of Leadership and Self-Deception. Just came out yesterday, in fact. That's been an amazing book for us, Anatomy of Peace, then some years later, which has really expanded our work in a whole bunch of other ways around the world. So that sort of was my personal path. Now, in my own role within Arbinger, that changed over time. But it's just been this personal growth path, really, for me, and then collectively as an organization, as many, many more people now have joined Arbinger over the years and in many roles all around the world. It's been an exhilarating ride.
Would it be accurate to say that Arbinger is a word-of-mouth phenomenon? Is that how the initial growth took place?
Oh, I'd say for sure, because we've historically not even done any marketing. So early on, when we had no writings, we were just passed word of mouth between clients, starting with Leadership and Self-Deception and then later with Anatomy of Peace. That word of mouth, the same thing started happening around our publications. The books really have captured people. They've struck a nerve. I think have met needs in surprising ways, and so people talk about them. And so even the books have not been marketed. They just grow and grow and grow each year, outselling the year before, which is unheard of in the book industry. Now it's been a decade with Leadership and Self-Deception. That's still the case. So, there's no question, I think, that the word-of-mouth phenomenon is a good way to describe what's happened.
Do you have a particular incident or story that illustrates the impact Arbinger can have on an organization?
Well, wow. Many, many, many. Look, I'll just tell a couple. Here's one that was very surprising just to kind of live through, to see it happen in the moment. We were working with a company, and this particular company, something had happened in the company, was a major event which required them to cut costs dramatically in a short period of time. And in fact, what they had to do is they had to cut $70 million from the cost side of their operation within 4 months. And they were all up in arms not knowing how they were going to do that. They assumed the only way they could do that was to lay off a whole bunch of people. And they asked us to help with that, to help them lay off their people. Well, we said, now look, we'll work with you on one condition. It's that you don't assume on the front end that the answer is you have to lay off a bunch of people. Sometimes that's necessary for economic reasons, but don't begin with that assumption. Instead, if what you have to do is cut $70 million, let's start there, and let's find all the possible ways that we might be able to do that. And so they agreed to that. And in the first day together working on that engagement, as they were thinking of each other, as they were thinking about the impact of their own work on others' work, as they were thinking about the impact in the community of changes that they were considering, it got them to a place, and it's what this material does, is it gets people out of this very narrow space of self-concern, which is where we normally operate from. And they were their concerns were broadened. I mean, they were thinking of each other and of others. And in that context, one of the executives of the company came up with the idea that if she were to fold her part of the organization beneath a colleague's part of the organization, they might be able to save a lot of money because of some redundancies and equipment used and other sorts of things between those two parts of the organization. And so she actually proposed in a little exercise that we had where people were meeting with each other and proposing things they might be able to do to help one another. Well, she actually proposed that she fold herself and her organization beneath this colleague's organization. Well, that's a stunning thing. That doesn't happen in business, where this is essentially a demotion for her to step down a level in an organization would never occur to anyone who is acting out of self-concern. But when one gets out of the box, to use Arbinger terminology, a whole bunch of things that were impossible before become possible. And so she offered this. They did it. They saved millions of dollars in that particular change. And what happened over the period of 4 months is they were able to save the full $70 million without laying off one person. And that's just an example among just thousands of kind of shocking things that happen when people get these ideas into their bones and then start working on the practical implications of them, whether in their business lives or their personal lives. I mean, one of the things that's exciting to me is that I know every time we go into an organization, for example, the organization is not the only thing that's going to change. The organization will change because the individuals within the organization change. That is, their the way they work changes, and And that also means that because our work is so deep, those changes don't stop at the corporate door. I mean, they're changes that travel home. I mean, their home life has changed. Personal lives are transformed. I remember there was one fellow, this goes back a number of years, but I'll never forget this story. We did a little thing in a seminar that we'd done in this particular company. It's not something we ever really do, but we did it then where we had after a couple of days together, the people in the group sort of wrote down on an index card for each other person in the group, you know, something that they'd noticed in that other person. And so we gathered these and handed the stack of index cards to each of the people in the room. Well, they're really quite tremendous things that people had written about them. Well, this one particular fellow goes home, gives the stack of items that had been written about him to his wife. She reads them and says, "I don't know who they're talking about here because this isn't what you're like." and in fact, she said, we came back on the third morning, and he told the group that I'm today at lunch, my wife's coming in, I'm going to lunch with my wife today because she says, "You're not like this in the evening time. I want to see what you're like in the daytime." Well, what had happened with him was that he was changing in the daytime too, and that was noticed at home. These changes sort of change us deeply, and that's one of the things that excites me so much. I mean, marriages change, relationships with children are saved, et cetera. And in addition, these marvelous things happen in the workplace that transform organizational effectiveness and such. So I love what I do and what we do for all of those reasons.
Mm-hmm. To be able to see deep change, not just what happens in the seminar or in a workplace, for example, but extends into the individual's personal life, that's got to be a great feeling.
That's really one of the things I think that's unique about our work. It's the level at which change happens. And the reason why our work, I think, enables that kind of change is because the very nature of our work takes people to deeper places than most other work does. And here's why. Here's a sense of why. And let me give you an example from a piece of work that we're doing right now in the legal area around the issue of civility. There's a big problem that's recognized in the law amongst lawyers. It's recognized by judges. And there have been rules that most states, probably all of them now, have promulgated around the necessity to increase civility in the courtroom, you know, between counsel, et cetera. Well, so we're doing work now in this arena as well. And one of the things we show early on with folks is that civility isn't what you think it is. Because, you know, you can think of probably a million stories. I mean, I'll give you just a quick example of one where it's a home example with me where my wife and I had a disagreement around mowing the lawn once. In fact, this is a story that's in our book, The Anatomy of Peace. So, and it had to do with edging, and she felt like the edging needed to happen, and I thought it didn't need to happen, and we had a bit of an altercation around that. Well, near the end, feel like, I'm going to rise above this and I'm going to do the right thing then. And so I say to her, I say, okay, I will edge then, which is what she wanted. I'll edge then to keep peace in the family, I said, sanctimoniously, no doubt. And then I went out and edged as I certainly had never edged before. I mean, I edged and I edged and I edged and I edged and I edged. Well, but of course you hear that, and everybody knows just in hearing that, that when I came back in the house, that didn't increase peace in the family. And even though I did on the outside what she wanted me to do, and in fact, even did it more perhaps than she could have even dreamed of, it didn't increase peace in the family. So in one sense, I ended up acting civil. I ended up doing what she wanted. I ended up complying. That's sort of an outward civil act. But what that story and all other stories like it reveals is that there's a deeper matter at play here. And even if I'm saying the quote-unquote right thing or the nice thing, even if my words are pristine, if my attitude isn't, then that will infect everything. And that's what Arbinger's work shows, is that it's not enough only to be civil, for example, in our behaviors, in our words. If my quote-unquote civil words are undergirded by deep incivility in my attitudes toward other people. That's what will come through, and that's what other people will feel from us. And they will not respond. I will not be inviting them to respond civilly. And so if we're going to be able to crack the problem of incivility, for example, if we're going to be able to really build teamwork in an organization where teamwork is lagging, it is never enough to merely tackle the problem behaviorally. And that's why Arbinger's work can take people to deeper levels of change, because our work is not merely behavioral work. Behaviors matter. They matter a lot. But it's just that there's something deeper than behavior that matters even more. And Arbinger's work illustrates what that is and equips people with a language that allows people to understand what this deeper thing is and what to do about it with precision. And so Arbinger, I think, surprising to people because it sort of opens one's eyes. It certainly has done this for me. It opens our eyes to entirely new possibilities and therefore also new possibilities of change.
That's a great story. Reminds me of the discovery that I can say all the right things or do the right behaviors, but it's really that something deeper, this how I'm actually fundamentally seeing the other person that determines my influence with them and the success of our relationship.
You can look around and there are behavioral problems. Someone's doing something behaviorally they shouldn't be doing, and it's creating trouble either in a family or in a workplace or on the world stage even. Mm. We can see all those things. But, you know, it's just as frequent that someone's doing, quote-unquote, the right thing on the outside, but they're doing it in such a way that it's causing all kinds of trouble for other people, and it's because there's something deeper than behavior that's in play here. And you see that, I mean, it's very easy to see in a home life. I mean, I can be cooking a meal, for example, for my family and be in a rage that I'm having to do it again and again and again or whatever, right? And that's what the others around me will pick up on. And, of course, then they won't appreciate my efforts enough, and then I'll be bothered because don't you appreciate that I'm doing all these things? I mean, you're not doing it, I am, et cetera, et cetera. And we get ourselves in this cycle where we're just sort of spinning out of control, mutually blaming each other. And I'm just blind to my own role in that. And Arbinger takes the blinders off of situations like that and others where we can get down to the real issues, the deep issues, and begin to correct them.
You've used the words disease and infect in relation to being self-deceived or being in the box. It's interesting word choice. I think of the story of Ignaz Semmelweis, the Vienna physician. Will you relate that story for us?
Yes, this is a story out of Leadership and Self-Deception. So there was this physician many, many, many years ago named Ignaz Semmelweis, who was working out of a hospital in Vienna called Vienna General Hospital. And this is before germ theory had been formulated in medicine. And there was a conundrum there at the hospital around the death rate among women who came in. They were giving birth, and they were dying at alarming rates. In fact, there were two wards in the hospital. One of the wards, the babies were being delivered by physicians. The other ward, the babies were being delivered by midwives. And the ward where the physicians were working had a much higher death rate. And this particular disease at the time was called childbed fever. These women were coming down with something and dying at such an alarming rate that many women there in Vienna were actually giving birth out on the street first and then going to the hospital afterwards, because word had sort of gotten around. That is not a place you want to be to deliver a child. Well, Semmelweis was trying to get to the bottom of this, and he tried everything he could think of. I mean, he tried to standardize the protocols between the wards. They were trying to aerate, open windows, get ventilation going. They were washing the bedding. I mean, they were doing everything they could think of. Nothing made a dent in this problem and in the difference in the mortality rates between the wards, until he finally stumbled on something that it came about because one of his mentors had been working on cadavers in the basement of the hospital, which is something Semmelweis himself often did. And he had, while he did this, nicked himself with a knife And it turns out this mentor came down with the same thing that the women had come down with, and he passed away. And then Semmelweis started looking at how when he himself had left on a vacation, well, he was away for some time, a period of months, and he went back and reconstructed the stats, he realized that the women had died at much lower rates while he was away, and he thought, well, what is going on? And he realized what the only difference was, I'm working with cadavers a lot, and more so than my colleagues even, and he started to piece together this theory that really was the precursor to germ theory, and he postulated that they were passing, these particles were being passed from the hands of the physicians who were working on cadavers to these women. So these doctors had all good intentions. They just lacked a basic understanding, and they, without knowing it, were passing the germ of this germ of death in this case onto these women. And we use this as an analogy because when we're in the box of self-deception, we don't realize we are, and we're blind to many of the effects we're having on those around us. And we can even have good intentions, such as they are, but we just are blind to the fact we're coming from sort of a diseased way of being that ends up infecting other folks, and we end up spreading this germ around to the folks who are around us, within our families, within our companies, or in any context. And so Semmelweis ended up coming up with a way. He actually had a chlorine and lime solution that he would wash in, and he begged his fellow physicians to wash in. And when they started doing this, the death rate fell way, 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 way down. And in the same way, there's a way to handle this too, personally and organizationally, so that the terrible effects of this very common trouble of be getting in this box of self-deception can be overcome.
One lesson there being that we check our own hands first. That could be a hard lesson.
You don't want to even think of the possibility that I might be the trouble, especially when you're one of the doctors in this case. And by definition, I'm one of the helpers, right? But we can get ourselves in situation in our lives where we just make the assumption that we're one of the helpers. I mean, we're the ones who are making the good things happen. And we just can go through life assuming that and be completely blind to how we, too, are carrying something that isn't helpful at all. And that's so part of the trick here is how is it that we can invite people to see things they might not want to see? And that's part of Arbinger's work is we have a process. It comes out in our books, too, by the way the books unfold through stories that people see themselves in. It's not just that our work teaches people about this problem and what to do about it. Arbinger's way is to learn these ideas in such a way that it opens people both to the possibility and then awakens within them the desire to change things they otherwise wouldn't have wanted either to see or to change. Now, that's part of, I think, the power of our work, whether that work is in person with an Arbinger facilitator or whether one is just encountering it through reading one of our books.
Let's talk a bit about the second edition of Leadership in Self-Deception that was released in January 2010. The book is authored by the Arbinger Institute. Can you tell us a little bit about Arbinger's style of group authorship?
Well, yeah, you know, it's one of the things I think that's unique about us in terms of our publications. It's kind of odd, I think, for people that they encounter these books that are very personal books, and they take people to very personal places. But the byline, I mean, the author is listed as the Arbinger Institute. Well, there are a few things that went into that decision for us. One was, and this was the major thing, we wanted people to stay focused on the material and that they're encountering in our work and not get caught up in personalities or anything like that. And sort of a parallel issue was we wanted to save these ideas from ourselves within Arbinger. We didn't want to run the risk of infecting Arbinger and this work with the very problem of the box and ego that comes from it. And, you know, people have different roles, and some people write, and other people do other things in an organization, and we believe everyone's just as important as everyone else, and it wouldn't be right for a particular person or persons to get a lot of notoriety and others don't. I mean, that's just a recipe for resentment, perhaps. And our work is about, among other things, how to avoid that. And And so we wanted to sort of be true to our principles and not infect this work itself. And so that's a decision we made early on, which was that this our written work was going to be anonymous, and people would just encounter the materials and grapple with it. And although that, I think, was an odd way to go out in the beginning, it's proven to be really wonderful over the years. And so many people have commented to us that really struck them, because it seems so not the way things are normally done.
In the second edition of Leadership and Self-Deception, are there significant changes in it? Or, you know, what could readers look forward to?
That's a great question, because early on, I actually resisted the idea of a second edition even, because here we have a book it really is working. I mean, it's out in the world. It's growing every year. There's a ton of buzz about it, great word of mouth. I mean, it's not like it's a brand that needs to be pumped up a second time. And so I sort of resisted the idea. And in fact, I thought that a second edition was probably unnecessary based on the success of the book. And two, in some ways, might even undercut the idea that here we have a timeless idea and a timeless story. And so coming out with sort of a second edition somehow seems to undercut that very idea. Well, so I went into this assuming that, okay, there are a number of things we could perhaps add in the back of the book after the story that'll be helpful for people, which we've done. But I've been surprised by the improvements we've made. I mean, it's the same story, but there are improvements to it, to the story, and there are additional clarifications made. And even the body of the book, which was around 170 pages originally, is about 180 now. It's about 10 pages longer. It's also tighter, though, so there's actually more additional content than just 10 pages. There's some ideas that I think are explained more helpfully. And it's an improved book. And then in the back, in addition, we've included materials like, you know, what uses are people making of the book around the world, and how you can use the book in different kinds of ways for different kinds of purposes. And I think people really find those ideas helpful as well. So I didn't think there'd be any changes to speak of. But now, having gone through it, it is improved. I mean, it's been a great book that's been, I think, improved even further.
What would you say to someone who thinks they know someone who really needs to read this book?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We kind of laugh about it a bit, because Leadership and Self-Deception as a title isn't really a great gift title. I mean, if you see people that has this particular problem, and you go to them and you say, here, I think you really need this book, and they look at the title, Leadership and Self-Deception, it can feel kind of accusatory. So, you know, I think this is true of everything in life, but it's best to sort of start with oneself. And if there's a person I think could use it, if I could just stay alive to, yeah, and I need it too, that will help me to be able to pass on the book in the most helpful sort of way. And it might sound like this. I mean, maybe let's say I have a friend named John who I think could be helped by it. I mean, or I work with John, let's say, and maybe to say something like, hey, John, here's a book that'll help you to work with me when I'm really being a jerk, or something like that, sort of takes the pressure off John. Or just to say, you know, here's a book that I found really helpful for myself. You might find some insight in it as well, but it's been great for me. Something like that, I think, would really help people. And then you don't have to shy away from giving it at all. I mean, it's been amazing what this book has done for people as it's traveled the world. I mean, we just received countless stories, thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of marriages being saved as a result of this book that looks like a business book, for example, not to mention the business impact that it's had. So I certainly wouldn't shy away from passing it around to people. I'd just be humble in the way I did it.
Good counsel, Jim. It's been great to talk with you today. Thank you.
Sure.
I've been speaking with Jim Farrell, CEO of the Arbinger Institute. To learn more about Arbinger, you can check out their website at www.arbinger.com. As well, you can join Arbinger's free online discussion forum, www.arbingercommunity.ning, that's ning.com. Barrett Kohler is the publisher of Leadership and Self-Deception, as well as the book's prequel, The Anatomy of Peace. You'll find a flash movie of Dr. Semmelweis's story at www.bkconnection.com/leadership. Thanks again, Jim. All the best with Arbinger's work and with the second edition of Leadership and Self-Deception.
Thank you, Heather.